It's 8:06 on this Tuesday morning, July 8th. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Good morning. We've got 65 degrees now in Old Town Park City, 61 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for the Wasatch Back Forecast for your Tuesday. We're looking at lots of sunshine. That's going to be the theme not only for today, but as we go throughout the next several days. Temperatures will be on the climb over the next few days here with all that sunshine out there as well. Park City, we're going to be seeing those highs climbing all the way into the upper 80s to right around 90 degrees for a high temperature. Our friends in the Heber Valley, yeah, you guessed it, lots of sunshine, but even warmer weather is expected as we're going to be looking at those high temperatures jumping into the mid 90s across the region this afternoon, so quite toasty for us as we go throughout your Monday or Tuesday afternoon out there. As we go into your Wednesday, expect the heat to stick around. We're looking at high temperatures around 90 in Park City for your Wednesday afternoon. We'll see those highs in the mid-90s in the Heber Valley, once again, mid to upper 90s. One thing you will notice, especially as we get towards your Wednesday afternoon, those winds out of the southwest pick up and become gusty between 15 to 25 miles per hour, but we could see gusts up to 35 miles per hour at times. Of course, that's a concern with the dry air and the dry vegetation around could lead to an elevated fire danger threat for us as we go throughout that time frame. So we'll keep a close eye on that. But either way, it's going to be hot, sunny, and windy as we go into your Wednesday. Now, that wind will increase ahead of a front that's going to be moving our way Wednesday night. Now, that front's not going to bring us a major drop in temperatures, but it will bring us a cool down here as we get towards the end of the week, which will be well welcome. In fact, as we go into your Thursday, high temperatures will go for down to about the upper 70s. To low 80s for highs in Park City, and we'll look at those high temperatures dropping below 90 in the Heber Valley. Friday will feature a nice end to the work week with lots of sunshine. High temperatures will be in the low 80s for us in Park City for your Friday afternoon. Highs will be only in the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley with lots of sunshine for your Friday afternoon. But as we head into your weekend, get ready for the heat to return back to the mid to upper 80s for highs in Park City with lots of sunshine. Highs back into the low to mid 90s in the Heber Valley with lots of sunshine. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
It's 8:08. Coming up on the local news hour, stay tuned. We'll be talking with the general manager of Mountain Regional Water District, Andy Garland, talking about the proposed expansion plans, bonding, and an upcoming public hearing. Later on, former Park City Council member Dick Peek and his wife Laura Ritter with details on their world tour on a sailboat. And People's Health Clinic Behavioral Health Program Director Lindsay Brabant has details about the behavioral health services that the clinic offers. Well, Lower Pine Brook saw a rash of vehicle burglaries last week. Sheriff's deputies think a thief was able to open lock cars with new technology. KPCW's Connor Thomas explains.
The break-ins occurred on Wildflower Court, Ingen Loop, and Cottage Loop late July 2nd and early July 3rd. And at least in the case of Ingen and Cottage Loop, residents say their cars were locked. Ingen Loop resident Melissa Allen says her daughter's and her neighbor's cars were broken into. Her driveway camera shows someone in a mask and gloves simply opening the locked car door.
It looked like, appeared to have this person had a device in there, would be their left hand. And so, of course, my stomach dropped when I saw that, and I said, you know, call the police. I have it on film.
The cases are under investigation, but Summit County Sheriff's Office spokesperson Skylar Talbot says deputies' best theory is what's called a relay attack. That's where someone uses a device to boost a key fob signal, even if it's inside a building, to unlock a car.
Now, a lot of times folks will keep an extra fob in their locked car. We would certainly advise against that because the closer that fob is to those devices, the easier it's going to be for them to pick up that signal and use that to gain access to your car.
Allen says her daughter's keys were on the stairs near their front door, but she says they were lucky. There was no damage to the car, and only her daughter's work ID card was taken. Allen's neighbor's car was a rental and didn't contain anything valuable either.
So a big bust for them.
Talbot says a wallet was taken from the car on Wildflower Court, but nothing of value was taken from Cottage Loop. The burglaries happened between 10:40 p.m. and 2:40 a.m. Based on surveillance footage, deputies don't have any reason to believe more than one person was involved in the thefts. There aren't any suspects right now. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Officers with the Utah Department of Natural Resources and Division of Wildlife Resource Technicians inspected more than 10,000 boats over the 4th of July weekend. They checked watercraft for quagga mussels and other aquatic invasive species to prevent the creatures from spreading across state waters. More than 250 boats were decontaminated at Utah's 40 inspection stations over the weekend. In Utah, the only infected water body at this point is Lake Powell. Quagga mussels were first discovered in the reservoir in late 2012. The DWR says that this STD of the sea can plug water lines, infest water delivery systems, and can disturb natural ecosystems, hurting native fish species. These inspections are required for all boats and watercraft, including paddleboards and kayaks. The DWR also requires anyone launching vessels into Utah waters to take a free annual muscle-aware boater course. Well, a public hearing will be held later this month before a $43 million bond is approved by the Summit County Council to expand the Mountain Regional Water Treatment Plant. In the studios with details on this, as well as the 25th anniversary of Mountain Regional, I have the district's general manager, Andy Garland, along with assistant general manager, Lisa Hoffman. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So it's hard to believe it's been 25 years. I mean, maybe, Andy, can you give us the Reader's Digest version on how Mountain Regional even came to be?
Yeah, so Mountain Regional was formed in 2000 as water provider of last resort as different water companies in the basin started to fail. And since that, we've just continued to grow with all of the growth that we've experienced in the Snyderville Basin. And so one of the reasons why we're doing this expansion at the treatment plant is in anticipation of more growth.
Okay. Well, I remember when Mountain Regional was first formed, it was mostly because it involved one of my favorite interviews. It was with a Summit County commissioner. We were talking about the original $28 million bond that was able to purchase the water companies and then do some of the basic infrastructure to connect them all. I mean, and I had kind of figured out the annual payments, you know, that somebody would have to pay over the 20 years or so to pay off the bond. What was memorable about the interview was that I was accused of doing fuzzy math, and so I asked, well, Commissioner, then you do the math, and he came up with a number that was, you know, a third more. So he kind of backfired in front of him. But I guess that bond, that original bond, has long been paid off, or at least 5 years ago. Any idea?
It has been refunded, and we are in the process of getting that paid off shortly, actually. And that bond will be paid off as we take on this new debt for the expansion of the treatment plant. So the timing works out just great.
Okay. Well, before we get to the bond talk, any celebrations, I guess, planned for the 25th? Or?
So as you may or may not know, we're actually building our first permanent home right behind the High Valley Transit over in the F.J. Gilmore parcel. So we'll have a new administration building and a shop building, which should be delivered later this fall, so we'll be celebrating. We'll also be honoring. We still have three of our current employees that have had 25 years, Brian, Stacy, and Rick, so we'll be honoring them as well.
Okay. How was that paid for then, the new facilities?
So we did go out and get some debt with the Bank of Utah. That worked out very well. Our timing was good. So it was debt financed.
Okay, so that's separate from what we're talking about here?
That's correct.
All right. Any idea how much the district has grown over the past 2.5 decades?
Wow. Well, I know when I started 10 years ago, we were just over 3,000 customers, and we're up to just about 6,000 customers right now. So doubled in the last 10 years since I've been with Mountain Regional.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned, you do have this parameters resolution and public hearing coming up in order to borrow money to expand the treatment plant. So when and where is that hearing happening?
So that'll be happening on July 16th at the county council meeting. Lisa has worked diligently on helping us obtain a WIFIA loan, a water infrastructure loan through the federal government, which will allow us to feather in this debt. The treatment plant currently produces 2.6 million gallons a day. We'll be able to expand that to 5.5 million gallons a day. There'll be some, part of that is for new growth, and a lot of that's also for redundancy, allowing us to take our full allocation out of the Weber River.
Okay, that's significant.
Yeah, it is.
More than doubling. And so where is the water coming from?
It comes from the Weber River, from the shallow wells and from the exchange contracts that we have with Weber Basin Water Conservancy.
All right. And does that kind of take your allotment?
That will take our full allotment in the Weber Basin, in the river, yes.
All right. When I say yours, just Mountain Regional, because Park City also has been reserving water through Weber Basin, which comes through, I believe, your treatment plant, or at least
the raw water that we send them does not go through the treatment plant. It gets sent directly to the Quinns treatment plant. But with Park City's Three Kings treatment plant, they're not relying as much on the Quinns treatment plant as they had in the past.
Okay, so we're talking about $43 million of new debt, but again, we're going to add it on to some existing debt for a total of about $61 million?
Correct, and the 18 of that is current debt that we currently have on the books. We had thought about trying to do a refinance, but interest rates are too volatile right now for us to consider that. Will there ever be a time that the district's out of debt? I don't know if that's possible with all of the infrastructure and everything. When we took over parts of the system, Summit Park, you know, was built out in the early 60s. A lot of that infrastructure is failing. As you know, costs have gone up. So we go out and bid projects, and they're coming in higher than we previously anticipated. So we're always looking at ways to finance these projects and not burden the customer. But unfortunately, the only way we have to pay for replacement infrastructure is through our rates.
So let's talk about rates. What does that mean then to pay all of this money back?
Well, we're looking at just our normal 3-5% increase as we go through the next 5 years. This debt that we will take on has a delayed payment, so we actually won't be making our first payment until 2034. So that gives us some time to phase in that debt, grow our customer base, and then we would see probably in the 2034 timeframe, maybe an 8-9% increase. That's just if things remain constant. And, you know, 5 years is a long way out to predict what might happen with growth and such. But, at that time, the other debt that we had on our will come off, and then we'll start with this new debt for the treatment plant. And to go back to what Andy mentioned, too, is, and I know you're aware of this, but we've talked a lot about having to do an importation project at some point into the basin to make sure we have enough water. With the Three Kings coming on and the expansion of this treatment plant, it's at Signal Hill in our treatment plant, that's going to set up the area for water for a long time, decades. So this really, you know, the Three Kings and this treatment plant is really going to set the community up for a long time.
Okay, so why 9 years? Why such a long delay before you have to start paying back money?
Well, this is going to take a while for it to build. So we are just in the preliminary stages of actually developing the design for the treatment plant. So we're only at really a 30% design this summer, and we won't even start construction until the beginning of 2027. So once we get to that 2027, and that's the time we would actually start drawing down any funds on that loan, and then there's a 5-year delay that we can actually not make payments over that 5-year time as we're drawing down, like a construction loan, drawing down those funds. And then when the treatment plant comes online, and that 2034 timeframe, we would start making payments.
All right, so no payments, but interest still builds,
correct,
right?
Correct.
Yeah. So again, the money will be used to expand the treatment plant. What are we talking about? I mean, we're going to be treating twice as much water. Does that mean it gets twice as big?
It actually doesn't. The Signal Hill treatment plant actually sits up in Promontory in a very small parcel, so we're going to have to figure out how to Tetris the different pieces in there. We're going to expand the modules, the filtration system, so we can expand it, but it all has to be done within the existing footprint. We'll make a small improvement to a chemical building, but other than that, the general footprint of the building will not change.
All right. And that seems to be the biggest problem with drawing that water there out of the Weber River, right? Just the sediment that you have to deal with?
Correct.
Has that improved at all, or is that just something, an ongoing issue that you need
to deal
with?
It's an ongoing issue depending on flows, depending on season, depending on weather. It's a constant balancing act because you never know day to day what you're going to get. Unfortunately, things have been pretty constant. We always worry about fire in the high Uintas, what that could do to the treatment of water. So that's something that we're also considering in this design, how to be resilient in case of an emergency.
Yeah, what would fire do too?
It would be very devastating, depending on where it is and depending on the sediment in the river. So we're trying to plan for that. I mean, those are a lot of things that we have to do, is do the just in case, what if. So we may be building something that we may never use, but we absolutely need it.
Yeah. So once you start paying for the bond, it goes for what, another 20 years or so?
It's actually a total of a 40-year process. That's what really makes this, the WIFIA loan, really attractive. so we can extend the payments out over a longer period of time so it doesn't have a bigger impact on our customers. Yes, we will be paying for the accrued interest, but it allows us to feather in the rates at a lower interest or lower growth rate over time.
Yeah, what are we looking at, an interest rate? Because a lot of those loans are usually very low interest.
Yeah, right now it's kind of, it's about 4.9% right now is what we're looking at as an interest rate. as we've mentioned or we've heard, interest rates potentially are looking at being cut 2 times over the end of the year. We'll, you know, see where that ends up, but we wouldn't be closing this loan until the end of the year. And the other nice thing about the flexibility of this WIFI loan is we have the opportunity to reset that interest rate before we draw down funds. So we don't anticipate drawing down funds until 2027. So we have a full year to potentially get a lower interest rate if we see interest rates move in that direction before we pull. So we've got some flexibility. And
okay. So are you in your new administration offices yet?
Not until the end of the year.
Okay. All right. And then in the meantime, what, you'll have to, you're being paying a rent?
So we own a commercial condo over in the business park area by Home Depot, and the county will be purchasing that from us toward the end of the year. They're moving some people around.
Okay. So again, that public hearing is happening July 16th?
July 16th.
Okay.
6 p.m. in Colville.
All right. Let's move on. All of the construction work we've been seeing along 224 has been for Mountain Regional?
So it is part of the regionalization agreement. There is a new water line that is being run so Park City can deliver through the Weber Basin Agreement water to Summit Water. And what that will do, it'll further interconnect the three major water providers in the basin. It'll provide relief on the water system on the Highway 40 side, which would allow us to use that if we needed to, but it's part of the regionalization agreement to specifically deliver water to Summit Water.
All right, so you talk about the three, Park City Municipal, Summit Water Distribution, and Mountain Regional. What about some of the other smaller ones? I mean, we've got Gargoza still and Pinebrook. Are there others that need to kind of come into the system?
The good news is all of the water providers in the basins do have an interconnection. So if there was ever an emergency, we could deliver to, it may require wheeling through someone else's system to get water to the other system, but we are all interconnected. We do understand at the state level that the state is going to try to legislate and eliminate smaller water companies and consolidate so we can take advantage of scale. So we're not all competing against each other for the same aquifer.
Yeah. So who's paying for all of this? You're all sharing this jointly?
Collectively, we're each paying a third.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of project cost are we talking about there?
About $7 million.
Hmm. Okay. And it'll be done this year?
It should be done this year.
All right. And again, that then it's kind of complete? Everything's connected?
Till the next time, right? Till the next.
Okay. We are, again, in another sustained drought. What is the outlook on water?
Well, this year right now, we're good. We just don't know what the winter's going to provide, and a lot of our water comes from snowpack, and so we're getting too confident in what we're seeing in the reservoirs today. We need to make sure that we're preparing for the future because there's no guarantee that we're going to have a good winter. Mm-hmm. The reservoirs look full right now, but our consumption in June was 20% higher than it was a year ago, which is not the direction that we want to see people going in. We need to actually be going the other way, and I think they call it drought, what was it, conservation fatigue. People are seeing other people doing it. Things are green. We're just too dependent on a green lawn, and that's not where we need to be.
Well, June, of course, very hot and very dry. I don't know that we had a drop of rain all month. But again, when we talk about, you know, continued development, I mean, traffic always comes to the top of the list, but seems like we should be a little bit more worried about, do we have enough water to serve all of the growth that's anticipated?
We absolutely need to be concerned about that. Unfortunately, we don't get to drive the development. The development comes and we're told you got to figure out how to service it, but we need to change that messaging and that dynamic. We talk about affordable and attainable housing, but you could have an affordable rent payment or a housing payment, but if your water bill is $1,000 a month, how affordable is that? We need to look at things like that as we're developing in the community.
And you say we here locally, but it sounds like it's really kind of mandated by the state.
Yeah. I mean, it's not an isolated issue to Summit County. It is a statewide issue that we need to stop thinking about how we can build and build and build. We need to think about how we can conserve water and sustain what we have.
Yeah. So why not do some sort of study, some kind of carrying capacity that shows that it's like, you know, given sustained droughts, given low snowpacks, that this is really all we can develop? I mean, are people doing that? And whose job is that, I suppose?
There are different pockets of the population that are doing that. Unfortunately, that's not where developers make their money. Developers make money building and building and building. And so we need to really think about the model, because once the water's gone, you can't go to Walmart and buy it. Just doesn't exist. If it doesn't snow, we don't have the water, and that's concerning.
So what are your long-term projections for being able to meet the demands of this continued growth?
Since COVID, our growth has slowed down in the district, but we do keep seeing different projects creeping up. People are coming in and kicking the tires on what they could potentially do on some of the land. We are also talking about some of the neighboring smaller water companies or people that are on wells that are concerned that they're not getting the production. So they're asking to join the system. So I think you're going to see consolidation and more regionalization on how water is provided, which makes sense.
Okay. So how much are you seeing of people come off wells onto the system?
Every month or so, we have people that are doing it. Right now, we're in a study with Lake Rockport Estates to try to see if we can provide them water. I mean, it's a concern. Different parts. I mean, not only for drinking and safety, but fire, right? Is there fire flow?
And these developments then would be required to pay any costs associated with connecting the water system?
Correct. They would be charged an impact fee.
Okay. Let's real quick talk a little bit about a water line replacement happening in Summit Park. Again, that's a very dated, aged system as well.
Yeah, so one of the things that we've been able to do in the district is partner with the sewer district and the county as the county goes in and does road improvements, or the sewer district's improving a sewer line. When the trench is dug, it makes sense to do work once, to do all of the infrastructure improvements, and so we've been able to do that up on Matterhorn this summer.
All right, and you've also got this Cash for Grass program. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we have a Cash for Grass program called the Landscape Lawn Exchange Program, and we do that in partnership with the state and Weber Basin. And that's $3 for every square foot of grass removed and replaced with drought-tolerant landscaping. That we're looking at, you know, a minimum of 250 square feet in order to complete that project. And we've had quite a few customers take advantage of it, and we'd still like to promote that this summer.
Yeah, so it's making a difference.
It is. Yeah, every little bit counts. I mean, if you put that together and that adds up, and people are, you know, removing those highly irrigated areas with some drought-tolerant landscape that aren't active turf that people are using, it really does start to make a difference.
Yeah, so how does that mean that you then go forward being able to pay your bills, right? If people are using less water, you don't have the income from the water use, and then there may be a deficit, and then how is that made up?
Yep, so that's a balancing act that we try to play. We clearly, if people are using less water, it's not impacting our infrastructure as much, right? So we're not having to do those long-term capital projects quite as quickly. So there's a trade-off, but you know, we kind of try to take the long view of that, is we want to make sure we want to keep that infrastructure that we have in place in good working order, and if we're not using the system, much that helps.
Okay, and then finally, you've got a new solar array on top of the treatment plant there at Signal Hill?
Yeah, one of the things that we, Doug Evans actually several years ago came up with the idea of how can we better manage our utilities, and so we were able to, with Rocky Mountain Power and their Blue Sky program, we're able to float a solar array that basically offsets the cost of the energy cost of the Signal Hill treatment plant. It's available for tour if anyone is interested in going up and seeing it. It just is a unique project here in Utah.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
We will have a board member moving out of the district, so we will have an opening on our board if anyone's interesting that can apply with Summit County.
Okay, it's done through Summit County?
Correct.
Okay, Andy Garland, Lisa Hoffman, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, on March 28, 2018, former Park City residents Dick Peek and Laura Ritter, who had just sold their home in Park City, began their journey as circumnavigating the world. They finished their tour on sailboat. 7 years, 1 month, and 17 days later, they join me now on the phone with details. Good morning to both of you, and congratulations.
Thank you. Good morning, Leslie.
So,
good morning.
Dick, where am I talking to you from?
We are in San Diego.
Okay. Maybe give us the background story here. I mean, how did two people from Park City, Utah, a landlocked town, end up deciding to sail around the world?
Well, I had the dream in my 20s. I actually owned a sailboat, had the dream, had it all penciled in, but took a few decades to let reality catch up and ended up buying the boat and, you know, selling the house in Park City, and the dream came back alive and off we went.
Yeah. So, Laura, what inspired you to kind of join him on this journey? Was there a particular moment that kind of sparked the idea?
Well, I grew up sailing on Lake Michigan, and my parents had the dream, and especially my mom had the dream, and she never did it. So when Dick first said it was sell the house to buy a sailboat, I'm like, what are you talking about, living in the mountains for all those years? And then I decided, why not? Live the adventure. And so it's been wonderful.
Yeah, so it sounds like you both had quite a bit of sailing experience before setting out.
Yes, definitely compared to some other people that we've met, we had sailing experience, so that was good.
Okay, so what kind of boat did you sail on, and how did you decide on that one?
We got a 41-foot monohull sloop, so it's a single mast and a single mainsail, and we chose that after some research. We took a sailing seminar from a well-known cruising couple, and they kind of suggested some good ideas to have in a sailboat, and we kind of followed their advice and eventually found our Scepter 41 that we renamed Maya after the star in the Pleiades constellation, and it's been a great boat, and you know, never short on little project lists to complete. So, yeah.
So Laura, what were the biggest hurdles, I guess, in getting ready to leave pretty much everything behind?
Getting everything out of the house was a huge thing, but stressful last so many months of quitting our jobs and pulling everything together. But we didn't have the boat before we finished, so we did decide to start down here in San Diego, where Dick had family, and drive up the coast and look at boats. And decided we'd start from wherever we found the boat. And luckily, when we got up to Pacific Northwest, Maya showed up, and we were able to, she was actually up in Vancouver Island, and we brought her back down to the States and worked on her for 3-4 months to get her ready to sail. And then we started out by doing a sail up around Vancouver Island and checking her out and making sure I was ocean worthy, because I'd never really sailed on the ocean before. And it all came together.
So walk us through a typical day on board during your life at sea. Did they all feel the same?
Not necessarily, but because it depends, whether we're doing an ocean passage where we're going for so many nights overnight or a day trip. So right now we're preparing to sail up to San Diego. And so we've been doing our homework. We're always looking at the weather and then looking at what anchorages or where we can go to a mooring or a dock. And so we just kind of prepare, like tomorrow we're going to, sail up to Dana Point, and that's going to be a full day sail, 8 to 10 hours. And so we'll leave early, and knowing that it's summer and we have a lot of light, and we'll probably motor a lot too. I think we've motored a lot more than we thought we would, but it's just to get where you're going when you're going, when the weather's good.
Mm-hmm. So from San Diego, then, which direction did you go? South or east? Or west, well, I guess. I guess that was east, yeah.
Our first season, we went up into Baja, and we had our dog with us, Ellie, and she stayed with us for that journey and then came back up to San Diego for the hurricane season and got the boat ready further and adopted my dog. My cousin adopted my dog in San Diego County, and then we went down to Puerto Vallarta and really prepared there. And then by when the season opened up for cyclones and hurricanes in the South Pacific, we left Mexico and sailed out to the Marquesas Islands and began, you know, left the continent from Mexico.
So what was the longest stretch where there was no land?
Well, we've had three big ocean crossings. The longest one for us was sailing up the Atlantic from this small island.
St. Helena, where Napoleon was exiled in the middle of the South Atlantic.
And then all the way up to...
Tobago.
And in the Caribbean, yeah, and that was 29 days.
So what does life look like when you're in the middle of the ocean for 29 days?
Well, we tend to, you know, if we're in a consistent weather zone, like in the trade winds, it'll be, you know, one day will be very similar to the next, and we're, you know, just monitoring. One of us is always on deck or in the cockpit, monitoring the conditions and looking for, you know, floating objects and whatever. And then as we transition into other weather zones, like getting up to the doldrums at the equator or further away from the trade winds, you might have, you know, different weather patterns and cold fronts and things like that. And it's, they tend to blend together when you're in one weather zone, but then, once you're transitioning between weather zones, they kind of each day takes on its own character.
Mm-hmm. What was your longest stop at a place?
Oh, we got
When we got to Australia, actually, we were planning on spending a season or so there, and we were there when COVID came along, and we had a good 2-year stay there, which was actually one of the highlights of the trip, at least for me, because we got to sail up and down to the Great Barrier Reef, and we made a lot of good friends and really had a really just fun cruising couple years of not sailing across big oceans.
And talk a little bit about how you managed your food, fresh water, and any medical needs while you were at sea.
Well, we have quite a bit of storage on Maya, so carrying enough food was pretty much easy. We have a water maker, so we can make fresh water from salt water using a system that we installed. And then medical needs, you know, I don't know if people in Park City know, but I'm diabetic, and it just seems like everyone in the world has diabetes, so it's not hard to find the essential supplies and care. Medical care in other countries is, you know, just a normal thing. You go to a local doctor and you get your prescriptions, and, you know, no big deal. So,
yeah. Did you face any major storms or mechanical failures or any unexpected emergencies?
Yes. Storms, we were in the off of Africa between Madagascar and Mozambique, in the Mozambique Channel, as it's called, and these thunderstorms would roll up the ocean and then curve into Africa, and we got clipped by one that was very impressive looking, and it turned out to be actually very impressive in reality. So that was exciting. And then mechanical challenges. Yeah, we had various things that would, you know, tap into my ability to you know, being a former contractor, just kind of figure it out. And, you know, a starter stops working in the middle of the ocean, and we had a battery that started bubbling over. And, you know, what do we do? You know, on and on. But each challenge is, you know, we kind of keep the big picture out, you know, just shut down the system, keep sailing, you know, and maybe the next morning deal with it. You know, just take time and keep things safe, and, you know, keep the priorities aligned.
Yeah, so what did you have in the event of something, you know? I mean, if you needed Mayday, did you have some kind of satellite phone or Wi-Fi or anything that you could contact somebody?
Yes, we had the Iridium Go is a device that we were connected the whole time while we were out there, so we could message people if anything like that happened. We also have a radio that you'd broadcast on. We were connected to people by, you know, text and email the whole time. So that was really well. And the last year we did get Starlink, and that's helped too, because we can continue to use that while we're, talking to you. We have this great connection, and, being, offshore too, we can use that to, get the word out if we have any major problems.
Yeah, so maybe share what did you learn about yourself and perhaps each other during the voyage?
Ooh, boy. You know, I think a lot, because what people are asking what you learn. One of the things that I'm still fearful. I have a lot of fear, especially sailing at night. One of the last night shifts I did, when the moon's out and it's bright and it's lovely and there's not a lot of clouds, even just with the stars, you can still see around. But the moon went down and it was a really dark night, and Dick came up to take over, and I said, you know, this is so scary. I hate sailing in the dark. So not that I learned much, except that I still have a lot of fear. We do get along well. I think we've learned when to be quiet and when to talk, and, you know, when each other needs their space pretty well.
Yeah. And for you, Dick?
Oh, I like the night passages, the challenges, the routine, the perseverance, I used to be into kind of long distance motorcycling and the day in, day out routine of a goal and just picking away at it and sticking with it. And, here we are. It's been a challenge, but we've learned a lot. And every day is, you know, we learn something new, and, you know, just add it to the quiver of knowledge.
Yeah. So any, the most breathtaking place you anchored at, would you agree on that spot, and where was it?
Well, in the northern Cook Islands, so you leave French Polynesia and you're sailing off towards Samoa, there's a little island called Suwarrow that is a guy wrote a book decades ago called An Island to Oneself, and it's just this little pair, several islands. Now it's a bird sanctuary, and a couple of local government guys from the Cook Islands are stationed there for the whole season, and they have a lovely, beautiful, vibrant, living coral and giant coconut crabs, and it's a stop in the middle of the Pacific that a lot of people go to. So we met a lot of friends that we're still friends with on their sailboats, and, you know, it was just wonderful. It was a wonderful, after the stress of a passage, to be surrounded by friends and warm, friendly, government officials, and it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah. So is Maya home now for you?
Maya's home. Go ahead.
Yeah, Maya's still home for us. We're going to sail up the coast here to Portland, Oregon, where our son Trevor is, and continue to live on Maya, though we're thinking of doing some house sitting. And next summer, we're thinking of continuing to sail and around the Pacific Northwest and maybe back up to Vancouver Island, where we feel like we started our journey.
Okay. So, I mean, that's kind of the plan. I mean, if you get back on land, it's going to be just house sitting.
For now it is, yes. We're kind of going to, you know, check around. We're not sure about moving back to Utah at this point, so we're just going to check out more of the country. When we first started, actually, we thought a lot about, is this, we'd stop in places, and could we live here? Could we live there? You know, could we live here? And so we're going to go up to Portland and see how it is. Still living, I think, close to the water for both of us and keeping the boat for now is one of the things we want to do, and the beautiful mountains and everything up there. So we're going to check that out.
Well, what an incredible journey. I'm glad you guys are home safe and sound, wherever home is. So again, congratulations. It's been fascinating to hear about. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslie. Yeah, it's great to be completed and have that checked off the list.
Yeah. All right. That's Dick Peek and Laura Ritter again, who just finished circumnavigating the world on their 41-foot sailboat. Thanks again, guys. Take care.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, in addition to medical care, the People's Health Clinic also provides behavioral health services. In the studio with details, I have Lindsay Brabant. She serves as the clinic's behavioral health program director. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, real close to that mic there. So start by, what is behavioral health? Define that for us.
Behavioral health is kind of like the care for your mind, your heart, your soul. It's the thing that supports our physical health as well. They're entwined, and we need both to really be a full human.
Okay, so when you see patients, what is it that they're suffering from?
A lot of times people come in and I say, what can I help you with? What can I do for you today? And they say, I don't know. That's the number one answer. It's something that is not going right in their life. They don't feel like themselves. They might feel like things are off balance. They're not sleeping well. They have a lot of pain, or they've experienced traumatic events, and they're ready to get some help with it.
All right. So talk a little bit about how many visits you saw in 2024, because it's pretty significant.
Yeah. In 2024, we had 1,797 patient visits, which is really impressive as a number. But when you think about behind every statistic is a real person, a real story, a real experience, someone as complicated as you or I.
Yeah, so we're not talking about 1,800 different people. We're just talking about hundreds, so seeing coming back several times, is
that
it?
Yeah, and sometimes we see people come back a couple of times and they're not quite ready for the reality of how to take care of the things that have happened to them or the things they're experiencing, but we might see them a year later.
Yeah, so you provide what? Mental health counseling, is that?
Yeah, so behavioral health care is very dynamic. So myself and we have a volunteer psychiatrist, Dr. Richard Martini, who's had an extremely distinguished career, provide really complex behavioral health medication management. So people with serious mental illness, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, trauma, depression, anxiety, all of those things, we can provide medication management. And so we address those issues with medications and different supportive therapies. We also have a new therapist that is joining our team officially in the role of therapist. Her name is Stephanie Santana, and she's been with the People's Health Clinic for a very long time, and she's been my partner since 2019. So several years she's worked as a coordinator for our patients and then also as a translator for me.
Oh, okay. And she's coming on board as a fully certified
then. Yes. So she completed her undergrad in psychology, and then she's finishing her master's degree as a clinical mental health counselor. And that's going to be a huge addition to our team.
Yeah. So it sounds like you've played a huge role in her development?
Yeah, so because some of the resources are limited for Spanish speakers to obtain therapy, I also specialize in trauma-specific therapies, and Stephanie has translated for me for the last 6 years. So she has been right in the visits and essentially helping connect me and my patients in that realm of healing.
All right. So how does somebody get help, behavioral health, at People's Health Clinic?
Yeah. So the People's Health Clinic serves people in Wasatch and Summit counties who are uninsured. Those are the two criteria for obtaining help. All you have to do is call us or come in, and we're happy to help you.
Yeah. And again, you're able to help them if they don't speak English?
Yes. So we believe that every person deserves to be seen, heard, or supported, no matter their status, background, or language. Really, the work in mental health care is rooted in the belief that healing starts with dignity. So if you speak a different language, we'll find a way to help you. We just want you to come in.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about the challenges that your patient population is seeing, especially this year with, the change in administration.
Yeah, sure. in order to really heal, sometimes people think that they're broken when they need behavioral health care or they want to work on their mental health. But our patients are not broken. They're resilient. They have incredible strength. They have generations of wisdom, faith, hope, and survival experience. And so it's not about fixing people. It's just about creating a place for their power to emerge. This year has been particularly difficult because, healthcare in general should be culturally affirming, it should be accessible, and it should be free from fear. No one should have to choose between safety and healing, and we need policy and practice that uplifts and not marginalizes. And so if you are afraid to ask for help, or you're afraid that asking for help might lead to family separation or just political uncertainty, then that's really terrible.
Yeah. All right. So again, can you tell us how people, if they are in need of services of People Health Clinic, how they reach you?
Yeah. So you can call our phone number. It's 435-333-1871. Or you can show up to the clinic. We're located just below the hospital, and we share a building with the Summit County Health Department. Just walk in and ask.
Okay. So you'll need some ID to show that you're a Summit or Wasatch County resident?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then just no insurance, no other help.
No insurance, and we're happy to see you.
Okay. Anything else, Lindsay, you want to tell us?
No, thanks for having me on.
Okay. Lindsay Broadbent is, again, the Behavioral Health Program Director with People's Health Clinic.